The last matter on the court's calendar this morning is State v. Peeler. We're ready for arguments from appellant. Counsel, could you state your name for the record and begin your presentation?
We're here on State v. Graham.
Oh, I'm sorry. State v. Graham. Oh. Not the wrong case. Sorry.
This made me more nervous. Good morning, Your Honor. It's Greg Engel on behalf of Randall Graham, the appellant in this case.
You may.
Your Honor, we brought two motions to the Court of Appeals' attention in this case. This is the DUI case. One of them is the destruction of a squad car video, and the other one is the expansion of the traffic stop after the initial traffic stop.
Can we start with the expansion argument?
Yes, sure.
Can you explain to us your expansion theory?
Well, our expansion theory is that it was illegal to take a regular traffic stop of going over the fog line and expanding it into a DUI stop. The court.
How was it expanded? When was it expanded? Okay.
It was expanded when the officer that made the initial stop of the vehicle decided to call in an officer who was better experienced on DUI stops, and then waiting until that officer appeared to turn over the stop to that officer. So the initial stop by...
Let me ask you this. How much time elapsed between the time it took between the stop and for the DWI officer to arrive?
The record, I think, by the officer who made the stop indicates he thought it was about 3 minutes.
And in that time, was your client seated in his car unencumbered?
Yes.
I'm just going to get right to it. Sure. I'm really struggling with the expansion argument here, okay, because normally in an expansion case, you have a stop for one thing.
Yes.
And then the investigation is expanded into something else as a result of circumstances learned during the stop. So you might just have a stop for speeding. The officer walks up to the car, observes indicia of intoxication. We expand to DWI.
Yes.
However, there is also case law involving stops for traffic violations that say in certain circumstances that traffic violation in conjunction with other circumstances gives rise to stop for DWI investigation. In other words, there isn't an expansion. It's the circumstances that justified the stop justified going straight to a DWI investigation. And what I'm wondering is whether those were the circumstances here.
That, I believe, is going to be the state's position, is that there was other behind-the-scenes evidence that allowed the initial stopping officer to expand to a DUI. Had the officer identified the driver, identified a smell of alcohol, identified...
But I know your arguments.
Car? Okay.
Right, I've got to ask because we... Our review is de novo of whether or not there was a Fourth Amendment violation or violation of the Minnesota Constitution arising from an allegedly illegal search and seizure.
Yeah.
So we're not bound by the district court's reasoning, and we're obligated to decide cases in accordance with law. There is a body of case law governing DWI stops, in other words, specifically stopping someone on suspicion of DWI based on a tip from either an anonymous source or a known source. And what that case law says is if a known source, a private citizen who's identified him or herself such that they can be held accountable for the information, calls the police and reports this vehicle appears to be an impaired driver, provides a description of the vehicle, the police track it down in a timely fashion, based on those circumstances alone, the police can do a DWI stop. What that case law also provides is if the tipster is unknown, we don't know anything about the tipster or why the tipster thinks this person's intoxicated, the police can't make a stop unless they find the vehicle and do something to corroborate the tip that it's an intoxicated driver. Here we seem to have the best of both worlds. I assume from the state's perspective, we have known tipster, it's a bartender at a bar. The stopping officer received communication of that tip. There's an allegedly intoxicated driver at this bar. Here's the vehicle. The stopping officer goes to that bar, observes that vehicle. Assuming there's no communication of any other information, that stopping officer observes that same vehicle, decides to follow it because it was the subject of a tip regarding driving under the influence, and in doing so, observes some traffic violations that are commonly associated with driving under the influence. I'm having a hard time understanding, if those are the facts, why the stopping officer did not have reasonable articulable suspicion to stop for DWI investigation, such that this wasn't like a routine traffic stop and, oh, we're all surprised, now we can't have a DWI investigation. Rather, this was a DWI stop from the get-go. And if it was, why wasn't it justified under the case law that says you can base the stop on information from a known tipster, especially where we have corroboration in terms of the location of the vehicle at the bar and traffic violations at like 12:30 at night? We have case law that says time of night is relevant because that's about bar close time.
There's a lot of intervening situations that took place from a report from a bar, from a bouncer saying a vehicle shows up. One important one is two people get out of the vehicle. There was no evidence at all of which one of those two people got into the vehicle after being at the bar for half hour, 45 minutes, and was driving. They didn't even determine who the driver was or tip that the same vehicle that was seen on the road earlier, that was, according to a bartender, looked like he was driving erratically because in a parallel park, he almost backed into the car in back of him, which is what you do when you parallel park because you have a camera on every car and you get as close as you can to fit. He didn't hit the car. He got close. The bartender said somebody in the vehicle stumbled, but more than one person got out of the vehicle. The officer who went to the bar to be pointed to, that is the driver of the car, never transferred that information to the officer who stopped the car for going over the fog line. And the officer who stopped the car going over the fog line never determined in his entire investigation who was driving and who was the passenger.
But the circumstance you're describing, that's in all the cases. There's one case where I think an ex-wife says, my husband, here's his name, he's drunk, he's driving, here's his car. The other cases are, I'm a clerk at the Q Petroleum station. Mm-hmm. Someone just left here, appears to be an intoxicated driver. Here's what the car looks like. Doesn't know the identity of the driver. And, you know, there's always the argument, well, in the 20 to 30 minutes it took for the police to find the vehicle, the driver could have switched. I mean, no one is saying that you still stop the car and investigate the DWI. I wonder how much these intervening circumstances matter.
Well, I see this car, he's driving all over the road. There's one person in the car. He pulled into the driveway of a house. Half hour later, the wife gets in the car and starts driving down the road. And the officer says, hey, I heard about that car half hour ago. I get to stop and do a DUI investigation because she went over the center line or the fog line. I think once you got that expansion of other intervening factors, this car was parked. There was more than one person in it. It could have been more than one person. He could have had a sober driver. The passenger could have been driving.
But none of that was known to the stopping officer. And all of those things could be said in any case where you have someone calling in saying, this car, this description appears to be an intoxicated driver.
So in my example, I guess if the court thinks the wife could have got pulled over and put through a get out of the car and do all the field sobriety tests because the car was seen swerving or parking erratically half hour previously, then I guess you can pretty much expand any stop into a DUI stop.
I'm just trying to figure out if this is really an expansion. Here's the other thing about the expansion doctrine. The reason we require, I think, you know, additional justification for each expansion is because each expansion is a greater intrusion on the individual's liberty. So what happened here is your client was driving the truck, it was stopped. He remained in the driver's seat, unrestrained, for 2 to 3 minutes while a second officer came to the scene. Is that really an expansion? Did that intrude on his liberty any more than it would have if it had just been walk up to the window, write a ticket for driving outside of your lane?
I believe there's two grounds that you can't expand. One is the time duration, and one is the factual duration.
Okay, so you're saying that the fact that one officer waited 2 to 3 minutes for a second officer to arrive, that constituted an unreasonable expansion of the seizure?
Into a DUI investigation. When the officer said, okay, I stopped the car for a traffic stop, not a DUI stop, because that was asked specifically.
But it doesn't matter what the officer said. I just want to stress this. It doesn't matter what the officer said. It's an objective determination, and we look at it de novo under the law and say, given the undisputed facts, would a reasonable officer in the stopping officer's position have had reasonable suspicion that whoever was driving that car was intoxicated based on the tip that had been provided earlier by a known informant and the observed driving behavior and the time of day and the location of the car at the bar or the truck at the bar a half hour earlier?
I guess you could take it to the position that anyone walking out of a bar can be stopped for a DUI, no matter how, if it's one cross over the fog line or whatnot, they can expand it to a DUI because of them. But that's all this tipster gave, is somebody driving up to a bar in a truck that looks like they were intoxicated. Remember, though, the intervening factor was the next officer, Officer Fandel, goes to the bar, and if he had enough probable cause or reasonable suspicion with the tip from a bartender saying that guy was driving that truck erratically, he looks drunk, the officer could have done a DUI investigation right there, I believe, of it. But he cleared the scene. He let him go. He said, I don't see any illegal activity here. I don't see anything wrong. So what this court is saying, so if my client would have got a sober driver or somebody else would have drove him home because there was more than one in the truck, doesn't matter, officer could have expanded it into a DWI based on whoever is driving that vehicle, based on the fact that that vehicle was seen earlier that day to be intoxicated and driving. I just don't believe the law extends that far.
I'm not saying it. The Minnesota Supreme Court said it in the City of Minnetonka versus Shepherd, 420 Northwestern 2nd, 887. And then this court said it in a published case, State v. Peeler, 488 Northwestern Reporter, 2nd edition, page 3. So I'm not making this up. This is what the case law says about when officers can do a DWI stop based upon a tip.
If I recall those cases, I think the tipster has to be identified.
But here the tipster was identified. We know who made the tip. It was a bartender at a particular bar who could be located and identified, which is what the case law talks about. He could be held accountable.
I think it was identified the next day. The officer says, I got to go back and get the statements and who these tips were. And the tipster didn't go to the officer who stopped the vehicle. The tip went to Officer Fandel, who then heard indicated
that's,
that
that's
he
was. That's exactly what happened in the Peeler case. Tipster calls in, provides information. The person who receives the information put it out to dispatch. We just received a call of a possible intoxicated driver.
So the Peeler case would be similar, is if an officer would have stopped that car, said no, there's no intoxicated driver in this car takes off a half hour later, this different officer said, hey, I heard there was a tip on that car, I'm going to stop it for a DUI. Because remember, in between the tip, the officers,
if this car was stopped and then the officer approached the driver's side, talked to the driver, and observed indicia of intoxication. And I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to say this was expanded into a DWI call before the officer interacted with your client and observed indicia of intoxication, which is the obvious basis to expand. I just don't know that you needed to get to that point before you could go up and communicate.
The fact that the officer found or went to the bar and investigated the tip and cleared it, And then it's that truck gets pulled over by a second officer because he heard that truck had a tip earlier. That was cleared by the first officer when he went to the bar and just cleared him. To say I can stop this truck a half hour earlier, and who's ever driving it, because I can see there's two people in there, I get to expand it to a DUI, and I don't do DUIs, or I'm not good at them, so I'm going to sit here and call in another officer to come in and do the DUI investigation.
Why does it say that in the record? I'm not recalling that. My understanding is that the officer who made the stop got called away to a medical emergency, and that's why he handed the investigation over to the officer that appeared to assist.
He first called the officers to assist, and he waited in his car for the next officer to assist. He called the same officer who had gone to the bar earlier and basically cleared the scene. He called him and he said, "Oh, that truck that you, I have driving conduct. I pulled him over." And then he didn't walk up and identify the driver. He didn't smell alcohol. He didn't. He waited.
This is in the record where?
In the transcript. In the omnibus. It wasn't until the two officers who showed up after Eckerson called him in that the second officer showed up, said, "You can now go and do a medical call." So then let him go to do a medical call.
I think we are at your time. We're going to hear from counsel for the state. You'll have time on rebuttal and we can talk about what you're bringing by.
Okay.
Introduce yourself for the record.
Good morning, Your Honors. James Morgan, appearing on behalf of the City of St. Joseph and the State of Minnesota. May it please the court, counsel. The state's position is that the primary driving focus in this case is a missing squad video. That is separate from the issue of the expansion of the traffic stop, but seems to be the crux of the appellant's arguments in this case. The state qualifies that video as missing instead of destroyed because there's not actually any evidence in the record here of the actual destruction of the video. It's presumed to be destroyed based on the fact that it's missing, but we don't have any evidence of when, how, or why that squad video actually was destroyed. Because there is no evidence of the destruction, the parties, both parties, only have speculative theories about the destruction itself. And only one theory, the theory offered by the state, fits the evidence of the case, which is that Officer Etchikin labeled the video a medical video because he left the stop to attend a medical call uninterrupted. And then it was later discovered in 2021 that all medical call videos had been destroyed from the year of 2019. What the appellant offers is suspicious circumstances that he relies on, but those are not supported by evidence in the case. The appellant has not presented a coherent theory delineating how he believes the conspiracy took place, or more importantly, why. There's no evidence in this case of any personal bias or ulterior motive. There are only circumstances that he has identified, taken out of context, that he finds suspicious, rejects any reasonable interpretation or explanation, and invites conjecture. This is a conspiracy theory in search of a narrative. There's three issues identified by the appellant that are before the court today. The first issue is the basis for the traffic stop. The appellant has framed this issue as a credibility determination. Officer Etchikin testified at the omnibus hearing that he observed the wheels of the vehicle cross over the fog line and make a wide right turn, crossing over into the oncoming lane of traffic before correcting into the proper lane. The appellant also testified in contradiction to Officer Etchikin's testimony. The standard that the court must use in order to find for the appellant in this case is clear error. It must be found that the district court acted in clear error in its determination that Officer Etchikin testified credibly. That is a high threshold, and the appellant has not met his burden in this case. The appellant's argument here is that because Officer Etchikin did not have a squad video to back up his testimony, then the testimony of the opposing witness, who tested at a 0.18 breath alcohol concentration and had no technical expertise related to the vehicle feature he claimed made his driving conduct impossible, not only should be believed, but it's clear error to believe otherwise. This argument does not make any sense to the state. Again, there are only suspicious circumstances that are identified by the appellant surrounding the absence of this squad video in support of this argument, attendant with all speculations and assumptions that appellant frames in his favor. The appellant's speculations about the missing squad video do not justify overruling the district court's credibility determination. Appellant has provided nothing that would demonstrate that determination was clear error, and the state therefore requests that the court affirm the district court's findings and order on this issue. The court has questioned extensively about the expansion of the stop. I would skip that issue unless there are other questions for the state. The third issue considered by the court, brought by the appellant, is whether or not this missing squad video violates the appellant's constitutional due process rights. The controlling case in this case is State v. Hawkinson. As the court knows, that the court goes through an analysis under this case through Maryland versus Brady first, and the key issue there is to determine whether or not that evidence is material, the absence of which caused prejudice to the appellant. Appellant focuses on the district court's statement that there's an equal likelihood that the squad video could have inculpated the appellant as it could have exculpated him. He then incorrectly and repeatedly interprets this to mean it is at least equally likely. However, the state disagrees with that interpretation. The state would compare this missing squad video to sort of the Schrodinger's cat of evidence. That's a thought experiment in quantum physics where a cat is placed into a box with a device that could kill the cat at any moment. After a certain period of time, the cat is considered to be equally likely to be both dead and alive until somebody opens the box. The difference in this case is that somebody did open the box. That person was Officer Etchikin. He opened the box and he reviewed the video. He wrote a report about it, and then he testified consistently with that report a year and a half later. Under Brady, the exculpatory value of the evidence must be apparent before the evidence was destroyed, meaning someone, anyone, must have looked at the evidence and recognized its exculpatory value. There's no indication of that in this case. In fact, the opposite is true. Officer Etchikin reviewed the squad video and he made a report based on what he saw. The facts in this case are similar to the State v. Hawkinson, where the BCA had destroyed a blood sample that was tested. They tested the sample before it was destroyed and wrote a report about that test. At most, the squad video in this case is only potentially exculpatory. Therefore, because it's only potentially exculpatory, the court looks to determine whether or not there was bad faith on the part of the state in destroying this evidence. And this is under this case of Arizona versus Youngblood. The appellant accuses the state of implying that there are only two indices of bad faith. In fact, the state did not intend to imply that there were only two indices. The state intended to state directly, and I'll quote from State v. Hawkinson directly, "The Supreme Court and our court have previously identified two indices of bad faith, whether the state purposefully destroyed evidence favorable to a defendant as so as to hide it, and two, whether the state failed to follow standard procedures when it destroyed the evidence." Appellant now indicates that this list should not be considered exclusive, but has not provided any guidance to the court about what a third index should be outside of suspicious circumstances that the appellant has identified. Suspicious circumstances is a vague and ambiguous standard that is not useful for a legal standard and should not be adopted by this court. Whether or not the state purposefully destroyed evidence favorable to defendant, again, there's no indication or evidence in this case that the police department knew that the video was what it was when it was destroyed, if it was destroyed. The appellant is taking a broad view here of intentional destruction, arguing that it could only be considered unintentional if it was destroyed by a fire or a computer malfunction. However, in State v. Hoggenson, the court differed from that interpretation, where the BCA intentionally destroyed a blood sample. It did so in consistently with its standard practices of destroying blood samples after 12 months, and the court held that that was not done in bad faith. The legal standard here under Youngblood is that it is purposeful, not intentional. The appellant has therefore failed to meet his burden of establishing that the squad video was destroyed in bad faith under this index. The second index identified by the Supreme Court is whether or not the state failed to follow standard procedures when it destroyed the evidence. There's no evidence in this case, again, that the state failed to follow the standard procedures. The St. Joseph Police Department's standard practice was to keep videos with criminal evidentiary value indefinitely. Certain types of videos identified by Chief Fannenstein, verbal warnings, test videos, and medical calls were destroyed after 1 year in order to clear space for the computer servers that are held by the police department. It was discovered in 2021 that all medical calls from 2019 were deleted sometime after that year, pursuant to the standard practice. Assuming the video was labeled a medical call, which would be consistent with the evidence that Officer Etchkin attended a medical call uninterrupted from the scene of the traffic stop, that medical call would have been destroyed as part of the standard practice of the St. Joseph Police Department. In State v. Hoggenson, quoting State v. Harris, court said, if the state follows standard practices, even negligent inventory practices do not evince bad faith. Therefore, the state asks that the court affirm the district court's findings and orders, ruling that the loss of Officer Etchkin's squad video did not violate the appellant's constitutional rights. That is the state's argument. Unless there are questions, the state will cede the remainder of the time.
Does not look like we have any more questions for the state.
Thank you.
Bye. With regard to the squad car video being destroyed, Your Honor, first of all, the question is it material evidence? When a police station or police department put squad car video into squad cars to film criminal activity and then has a policy to save those indefinitely or for at least 1 year, there's no question that this is evidence being produced for a criminal situation and it's material to the outcome of the criminal situation. Being destroyed, Chief Funnenstein indicated that he doesn't destroy any videos within 1 year. And the only ones that get destroyed after 1 year are test and or warning. This video was requested within 1 month of the traffic stop. On multiple occasions, one on the record, which the court record showed at the first hearing, and then followed up with a written request for video. This video was destroyed after it was requested by the defense in its defense with regards to this issue. There is the only explanation why this video doesn't exist is that Chief Funnenstein says he accidentally deleted it. And he doesn't even say that in his first letter. He says it does not exist. It must have been mistaken. Maybe he forgot to record. Maybe he forgot to turn on the camera. The video doesn't exist. The officer in the squad car then testifies, it did exist because I saw it. I reviewed it. Then they come back, well, then we must have accidentally deleted it. It must have been labeled as a medical call because he also did a medical call. However, in our request, in the first letter, he says, we keep all medical calls. We don't delete medical calls. Officer who labeled the video said, it's very unlikely I labeled it a medical call. I think it was a cross-examination question. Could you label it medical? That's very unlikely. So for the state to argue that's the most likely explanation that it was labeled a medical call is not supported at all by the.
But isn't what matters what the district court thought? Because what you're describing is a witness who's made inconsistent statements about what happened to the tape, and the finder of fact, in this case, the district court judge, had to determine whether or not those statements were credible.
And if they are, and if they're truly not credible, I mean, if they are.
Okay, well, elusive. The district court found them credible, and we defer to those credibility determinations.
I think that what we're asking is a de novo review of, was the evidence material? Was it destroyed in bad faith?
Do you get a de novo review of whether or not it was destroyed in bad faith? That seems like a factual determination that we would review for clear error.
I believe the facts are in dispute that it was destroyed.
Right, had an evidentiary hearing, and the district court made a decision that indicates he doesn't believe it was intentionally destroyed.
And he said that, but he says the tape was more exculpatory than, or either one. He said it could have gone any way. Under the Brady formula, if it's material evidence and it's destroyed even inadvertently, it's prejudicial to the defendant. So he, even if he says, "Well, I didn't mean to do it," if it's a Brady violation, it's unfavorable and it's exculpatory, and he made those findings inadvertent. The bad faith only comes in is if they find that it may have been material. We don't know that, and we're first argument is. Video squad car videos are material. We don't want a precedent that officers can review their videos and then destroy them and then say, well, I looked at it. It didn't show what you think it showed. I don't think we want the precedent. I don't think we want to go there. But even if we get to that, we have to prove bad faith. The fact that the officer gets on the stand and to boast his credibility says to the judge, well, I have a video. And that's the first time we heard there was a video of this stop. And he says, "Judge, I have a video." It's okay for an officer to stop a defendant. And the guy says, "I didn't do it." And he says, "Hey, we got a witness when they don't, or we got a video when they don't." But to do that to the court and to tell the judge, "I have a video," when the officer knew before he testified that it was missing, that he went looking for it, he and another officer went looking for it, it was missing. His candor to the court should have been, "I have a video, but it's missing." That may have turned the court's mind a little bit about why is it missing. Instead, the court says, I order you to produce it. Not, as the state says, "Oh, go find it." He never said it was missing, so the court would have never said, "Go find it." He said, "The video exists." There are case law we cite that when you say to a judge, "I have evidence that exists that you know has been destroyed or is missing," in the Conway case, I think, that in itself is bad faith to the court. Follow that up with the letter from Judge Funenstein that said the video never existed or does not exist. The only way he can know it does not exist is if he destroyed it. If you borrow me your golf clubs and I lose them and I can't find them, to turn around and say they never existed, they must have not been recorded, it must have not happened, why don't you go to your officer and say, "Did it exist?" And he says, "Yeah, it existed. I saw it. I wrote my report on it. I testified under oath it existed." So we came back and said, "Well, what's the contradiction here? One says it exists. The other one says it doesn't exist. Oh, it must have been destroyed." Then Officer Funenstein says, "I'm the only one who can destroy these tapes. Nobody else, just me." And then says, I must have accidentally destroyed it because we didn't have a power. He doesn't say, fire, craft,
computer. So I think I hear your argument to believe the district court should not have believed the police on this one.
I think that the district court followed the wrong standard of law with regards to material evidence that goes missing, such as the squad video.
Well, at this point, we've heard both from the state and the defense and rebuttal argument. Thank you. The case is well briefed and well argued. The matter is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.
Thank you. And thank you for coming to St. Cloud.
Oh, it's our pleasure. Thank you again to all the people who accommodated us. We do have some non-oral cases to consider, and we are going to the desk at this point.
Thank you.